Good evening. From our Newsfront studio at WNDT in New York, Thursday, December 12, 1968, and this is Newsfront on the Eastern Educational Network. I'm Mitchell Krause, and tonight, William Randolph Hearst Jr. and J. Kingsbury Smith preview the Paris talks. Former presidential assistant Bill Moyers analyzes the Nixon cabinet and some background on the life and times of Tallulah Bankhead. But first, for a summary of late news, here's Milt Haynes.
Good evening. At the present rate, the lion will lie down with the lamb before the Saigon government sits down in the same room with the National Liberation Front of the Viet Cong. Vice President Key agreed with Mr. Harriman and Cyrus Vance on new proposals to put before North Vietnam. The central issue is over the seating of the National Liberation Front. Whether there is one table with four sides, two tables, four tables, or whether the delegates stand to begin the expanded talks, it should be remembered that the fighting, full-scale fighting, continues in South Vietnam. American combat deaths passed 30,000 last week as 192 Americans died in the week of fighting ended last Saturday midnight. 1,110 Americans were wounded. 150 South Vietnamese soldiers were killed last week. 811 were wounded. And the Allies said they killed 1,715 North Vietnamese and National Liberation Front troops. The U.S. command said 422,979 soldiers from the communist side have been killed since 1961. The total American combat dead is now 30,057. 182,269 Americans have been wounded, almost 5,000 have died from accident and illness, and 1,250 are missing or captured. After Vice President Key had negotiated the new proposals with the American allies, he and Mrs. Key again went sightseeing and shopping in Paris. It was a good day for Mr. Nixon and the 12 new cabinet members. For Mr. Nixon, the newly selected cabinet, and for the future White House assistants, there were 8 hours of briefings, questions, answers. Nixon's Director of Communications, Herbert Klein, said that the president-elect had urged the cabinet designates to pick their own undersecretaries. Nixon, of course, will have veto power there. Senator Mansfield said the president-elect had told him in a phone conversation that he intends to be flexible in dealing with foreign policy. Senator Mansfield praised the selection of William Rogers as Secretary of State. The fact that he's not a foreign affairs expert is in his favor, Mansfield said. Mansfield told reporters that he hasn't the slightest idea of how Rogers stands on the Vietnam War. Mr. and Mrs. Nixon and their daughters visited the White House this afternoon and were warmly greeted by the president. Later, the president's daughter, Lucy Nugent, on the left, displayed the main dining room to Tricia Nixon. In Italy, Mariano Rumor finally put together a coalition cabinet from the parties of the center and of the left. That ends the 24-day government crisis. The 29th post-war Italian government is considerably to the left of those that governed in the last 5 years, with the socialists getting more posts and more important portfolios. There was a bitter picture from Prague from last night showing the Czechoslovak leadership applauding the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the Czechoslovak-Soviet Treaty. The Czech communist leadership is forming a new cabinet. And in West Germany, another of that country's starfighter F-104 fighter planes has crashed into the North Sea. It was the 91st starfighter crash. The pilot is missing. Senator Bartlett of Alaska died today in Cleveland at 64. His death followed arterial surgery 3 weeks ago. In Washington, Ethel Kennedy had her 11th child, a girl, 6 months after the death of Senator Kennedy. Both she and the child are well. Mrs. Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, had to admit before Parliament today that rats are given hundreds of pounds of food grains each week in ceremonial feedings at a temple in Bikaner. She condemned the practice of religious feedings of the rats when people, especially children, are suffering from lack of food. She said the 100 pounds of food grains given the rats daily was an isolated example and was not a general practice. From our newsroom in New York, that's the news. I'm Milt Haynes. Let's continue with Newsfront.
First Newsfront commentary, the Nixon cabinet. The analysis of former special assistant to President Johnson and now publisher of Newsday, Bill D. Moyers.
There is no occupation more hazardous than the business of trying to predict what men will do once they assume a public office. Washington, in particular, is like a refiner's fire. It brings out the best and the worst in men, depending on what is hidden beneath the surface of public respectability. How men respond to unforeseen events is the critical factor, not how many degrees they hold, or what companies they have run, or even what rhetoric they have employed in the past to state their views. So it is impossible to say tonight how the new Nixon cabinet will perform after the 20th of January. By national criterion, these are untried men. They are largely unknown men. In that sense, the whole country is gambling on them. In another sense, they have no mortgages to the past, to the liturgies and rituals that may have had meaning then, but are irrelevant now. It is interesting to observe whom Nixon did not appoint. No Rockefellers, no man like Adlai Stevenson with a large national following, no articulate spokesman for the blacks, no women. He seems to be saying, I'll stand or fall on my way of doing things, and he will. A president can put a cabinet together, he cannot hide behind it. The new Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Robert Finch, and the new Attorney General, John Mitchell, are both strong men. They're expected to emerge in their own right. The sleeper, however, may well be the new Secretary of State, William Rogers. Some doubt was expressed today that because of his inexperience in foreign affairs and his reserved nature, Rogers will be outmaneuvered by the more aggressive Melvin Laird at the Defense Department. Those who know Rogers believe this is not likely. He is quiet-spoken, but he's also quite tough. When he was counsel for the old Senate Investigation Subcommittee, Rogers was fair but firm. He is the man, in fact, most responsible for exposing Major General Harry Vaughan, the notorious White House military aide, and it was Rogers' investigations that sent Major General Bennett Myers to prison and forced the resignation of others who had betrayed their public trust. This man, then, is no milquetoast. The question mark remains Melvin Laird. He is the first partisan politician ever to be put in charge of the Pentagon. With its vast resources, its sheer size, the billions in contracts at its disposal, a shrewd politician could use the Pentagon for the benefit of his party. Laird has a reputation for skillful infighting, but he's also said to be honest. He will need both qualities to resist the temptations that march in and out of the Pentagon like armies in the night. The seeds for potential crisis are sown throughout this cabinet, from the moderate Bob Finch to the mildly liberal George Romney to the outspokenly liberal Pat Moynihan at the White House. Romney and Moynihan are not likely to remain silent if their sense of priorities is abused. Laird and his counterpart at the White House, Dr. Henry Kissinger, are totally different kind of men. It is hard to see how they can avoid clashing. There are no visible advocates in the cabinet of the most indignant groups in the country, especially the poor and the black and the lower income working man. Whether a kind of Midwestern cabinet reflecting the conservative mood which was basically responsible for the Nixon victory will or can listen to those beyond the pale, to the strident, angry, but legitimate dissent in this country, this may well be the critical question before the new team. Right now, all of this is ahead of us. For the moment, we can simply take note of the fact that power is passing from one administration to another. Lyndon Johnson may feel a touch of sadness as he looks out of that window at the platforms being built below for the inauguration of his successor. But he can also reflect with pride on a political system in which power passes from one order to another peacefully, without bitterness or threats of coup. And he and the old outgoing cabinet may even feel the relief with which Buchanan greeted Lincoln in 1860. If you are as happy, dear sir, to be entering this house as I am to be leaving it, you're the happiest man in the world. This is Bill Moyers.
Now Newsfront covers Vietnam and the discussions being joined in Paris. Each day brings new progress and a new setback, but observers still predict eventual movement forward. Tonight Newsfront presents two men off today for their own on-location assessment. They are veteran journalists William Randolph Hearst, Jr., editor-in-chief of Hearst Newspapers, and J. Kingsbury Smith, former publisher of the Journal American and general manager of International News Service, now chief European writer for Hearst. Mr. Hearst and Mr. Smith together won a Pulitzer Prize in the 50s for their series on their talks with Nikita Khrushchev. We recorded this interview shortly before they left for Paris on another of their frequent foreign reporting trips. Mr. Hurst and Mr. Smith, both of you have been following Vietnam for a number of years. Now you're going back to Paris to see what's happened over there. What do you think has happened so far since your visit there last May?
Mr. Joe's Smith? The resident observer.
Here we are in a new phase.
Well, I feel that the Paris talks have achieved a great more than I think is commonly realized at home. The impression, I think, has prevailed that these talks since the beginning have been deadlocked. And I don't think that's really so. I think that our two ambassadors over there, Harriman and Vance, have made a great deal of progress. As a result of their efforts there, we've had the bombing halt, the complete bombing halt. We've had the Hanoi and the Viet Cong prepared to come and sit down at the conference table and talk to not only us but to the South Vietnamese. I think the main positive result of their talks has been in the saving of American lives, because before we had this complete bombing halt, we were averaging a loss of 400 American soldiers a week. And in the weeks immediately following the bombing halt, that went down to 100 a week. Now, there's been renewed fighting in the last couple of weeks, and the figure is up closer to 200, I think, now. But nevertheless, a lot of American lives have been saved as a result of what Harriman and Vance have done to date in Paris.
You're not impatient, then, about this, Mr. Hurst? Are you impatient about the Paris pace? You've been back here while Mr. Smith has been over there.
The word impatience is something that we Americans do feel. There isn't any question about that. Whether you're labeled a hawk or a dove, you're impatient. As an American, I think, to get on with it. Whereas these Orientals, for the most part, can sweat it out. They know we're impatient. So they know they've got a built-in advantage there, it seems to me. They know darn well if they stall long enough, somebody's going to say over on this side, come on, come on, let's get cracking on this thing. And they'll probably get the point that they've been just plain immovable on.
Well, do you agree with Mr. Smith, his optimistic appraisal that we have come quite a few steps?
Churchill once said it was better to jaw than war. I won't say that the war stopped, but just being and talking about it, I would think is a better sign than not talking together, number one. I don't think you'd argue that. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I think they're there really because they want to be there. We've asked them to come to this peace table for a matter of 2 years. And I think they're there because they're hurting. So I think that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm. You referred to my optimism. I don't want to mislead you into believing that I think that we're near a peace settlement, because I don't believe so. But I do think that Harriman and Vance have made a great deal of progress at the Paris talks. And I don't share the belief that the Paris talks have been deadlocked since last May.
Now we're entering a very crucial phase, it is reported at least, with the final arrival of the South Vietnamese delegation led by Vice President Key. You know Key. You've met him on a number of occasions. What should we expect from this man?
Well, we probably again won't get exactly what everybody would like to get, and maybe we're expecting too much. Key, as all of the South Vietnamese are fighting for a great principle. They don't want to be under the yoke of the Northern Communist government. They've made that pretty clear. We came in at a time militarily when they were just about defeated. And we have saved their necks, and they're very grateful. And they did have an election last year, despite what you read in some of the anti-South Vietnamese government papers. I don't know why they should be anti-South Vietnamese. Maybe a commie government would quiet them down. But they're vociferous about the composition of Key and Q, who were elected. The other day in Venezuela, they elected a president. He had 29% of the vote. They don't have a runoff. There isn't a majority thing in some of these countries. But this little fellow is a very hard nut, and so is Chu. And he gave up his job, Key did, to the other one, the Chu, without a military struggle or a hassle, got no credit for it in this country to speak of.
What do you think of the speculation that was made right here on this program a little over a week ago by reporters back from Saigon that this was a smart political move on the part of President Tu, that sending his arch rival, Vice President Key, to Paris?
There's one thing they'll never be guilty of, is just reporting the news to people from Vietnam. They have to read something into every damn thing. If one sign says men and the other sign says women, they bet you somebody changed the signs, you know, like that, for some reason, I don't know. They all get to be big pundits about the thing over there.
Of course,
this fellow's over here because he's the vice president. He's keeping out of the hassle. He's keeping out of the immediate hassle. He's directing it.
Of course, you've covered international meetings, both of you, over the years, and it's a pretty dry problem for some reporters sometimes. There's not much actual hard news to report out of these conferences. You sit around and wait, and what do you write?
Well, it depends who you are, which the reporter you are, I guess. You can write no news is good news, or there's not much doing around here, which is the case. Or you can speculate away on who's, whether the cabinet of Dr. Kilgarry or Dick Nixon or anybody else is going to be, I guess.
Is this true?
Well, I don't think I've ever covered an international conference at which somebody didn't talk to some of the correspondents.
Yes. Well, how about Paris? Has this been a tough beat to cover for those reporters who've been there?
I don't believe it's been a tough beat to cover as far as the peace talks are concerned. Of course, the secret discussions, they got very little information about them. But they were kept reasonably well informed of the trend of developments.
Well, isn't the big problem in this kind of thing to sort out what all the sides want to propagandize, including our own, by releasing to the press, and the substantive progress or lack of progress within
really
the chamber?
Really, Joe's the expert on that. Mm. I get fed up with these guys. You know somebody like Avril Harriman or Cy Vance or somebody, and they will tell you, look, it's going all right. Don't ask too many questions because you might ask the wrong one, or you might stick your foot in it. Well, I'd rather not run that risk, frankly. There are a lot of reporters and newsmen who do. And if they don't get anything, they get mad at the person who won't tell them, and then they speculate and take a story and run with it. I don't believe in it. I think there's enough. I think the country comes first and the story comes second.
But hasn't the press been burned many times, especially in connection with Vietnam, because what they have been told has turned out not to be as is always, the so-called credibility gap.
Well, that was, in Washington?
Washington or in Saigon, or perhaps even in Paris.
Mm-hmm. I have not been conscious in the Paris talks of any of the correspondents having been misled by the American delegation. And I think from the very beginning that Harriman and Vance and the American spokesman have kept the correspondents well informed of the trend of developments. They haven't disclosed the details of their secret talks.
Bill Jordan still there?
And Bill Jordan, who's the chief spokesman there. I don't believe any reasonable correspondent could complain about the guidance that they've had, they've had from the American delegation.
Well, what kind of objective do we have in the Paris talks? Now, this is easy. Everyone says these are peace talks or will be peace talks, and obviously the objective would be to make peace in Vietnam. But
I think our major objective is to bring about a de-escalation of the fighting, to bring about a ceasefire and an end to the fighting. I think that's our major objective at the moment. I don't think, from the American standpoint. I think that the next objective is the hope that South Vietnam and North Vietnam can reach a peace settlement. But I don't believe that we expect to see the early conclusion of a peace settlement. I think what we hope to achieve in the course of the coming months is an agreement with the North Vietnamese for a gradual withdrawal of the North Vietnamese and the American forces from Vietnam and a de-escalation of the fighting.
Mr. Mr. Hearst, you know Mr. Key. What are his objectives, do you think, in going to Paris?
Well, I think ours, even, to begin with our own, whether it quite agrees with what Joe said, our objective all along is to persuade the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to cool it, to lay off. We thought if we came in and gave them a good shellacking that they would say, oops, we're in the wrong place at the wrong time and better get out of here and back off. They didn't do it as much as we thought. I'm sure that we miscalculated to a degree. Now then, we went on the peace kick and try that out and say, look here now, why don't we just talk it out? And you see, they can't win. Actually, the North Vietnamese can't win. If should we choose to stay, they can't win. Therefore, you could say to them, your only hope is to persuade us or dissuade us from staying. And maybe if you were real charming and everything, we might go away. Their long-run aims might be better served if they did have a ceasefire now, as Joe says, and the American public opinion says, get out and stay out. I doubt like blazes we'd go back in again if we made some arrangement with them and withdrew with honor and with honestly believing that the thing was settled and turned it over to the South Vietnamese. And if we felt that they double-crossed us, even so, I don't know whether the American public opinion would let this country go back in again.
Well, like so many of these international...
We could help them. Mm.
And domestic disputes, problems seem insoluble. The areas for compromise seem so limited.
Well, this is another thing. This goes with our impatience. It isn't an arithmetical problem with an answer that you can get in the back of the book or buy the little book that gives you all the answers. It isn't all that accurate. There are many insoluble problems. The Jews and the Arabs aren't going to kiss and make up, because, no matter how much work you do on it. And these boys aren't necessarily going to be buddy-buddies just because we're in there and working like hell to get them to be so. It may be a long... Kashmir and the Indians and the Pakistanis, I don't see are any further ahead. They may not be shooting right now, but their principles are established and they're still sore.
Do you think the United Nations would have been a better place to hold these talks? Arthur Goldberg on this program earlier this week said we should have gone to the UN earlier with the Vietnam thing.
We could have, but the United Nations practically asked us not to bring it there because it would embarrass them, because they couldn't do anything but literally jaw.
Well, now we're entering a new phase here in this country, too, with a new administration. And it's been said that everything will wait, really, until January 20th, until the new policies get started. What do you see as the possibility? Is this going to make a change in the basic way these talks are likely to be run? Will the replacement of a Harriman and a Vance change things, really, in the talks, do you think, Mr. Smith?
I doubt that they'll change it very basically. I doubt that Nixon will be able to pursue very much different policy than Johnson has pursued. I can't see Nixon agreeing to any settlement which would mean that we would pull out and turn South Vietnam, let the communists take over South Vietnam and have the 30,000 American boys that have lost their lives there having died in vain. I can't see Nixon doing that.
What about the reverse? Can you see him stepping up the pace of
personally that before the Vietnam conflict is over, Nixon is going to have to adopt a very strong attitude towards the North. I have a feeling that he's going to have to threaten them with something, I don't know just what, before he convinces them that he too is not willing to pull out.
Let me conclude. We just have a moment, Mr. Hearst, to ask for you to give us some gratuitous advice to the president-elect.
Free, you mean? Well, that's about what it's worth.
Do you think that a new initiative, it's often said that a new administration has an opportunity to make a new initiative, that one could be made in this situation?
Well, there is an opportunity, I'm sure. I imagine they think they know what Johnson's hand is, as it were, because it's just about played face up lately. He's come to the end of his term and of his thinking. It's up to Nixon to convince him that he's either tougher or weaker or something. I think he has a possibility of of bringing this thing to a conclusion sooner. Just exactly how, I couldn't swear, but I mean, it's not the same man, and so there ought to be a change in the tempo.
And his past behavior, Mr. Nixon's, wouldn't give you any indication of the kind of hand he'd be likely to play?
Looky, what a guy says when he's not the president and what he has to do when he's the president of the United States are very often two different things.
Well, gentlemen,
I doubt like blazes if Goldwater would have set fire to the world had he become president.
Perhaps you'll report back to us on your return to Paris.
Well, I'll be glad to if you
good,
want.
Good, we'd like to have you. Thank you very much, Mr. Hearst and Kingsbury Smith.
While the affairs of the world go on, there is a familiar face that will no longer be around to watch the passing parade. Milt Haynes reports.
tallulah Bankhead's idea of lunch was Vichy Soise and four daiquiris. She was married for a while to an actor named John Emery, who years later said he was still recuperating. Emery began to be disturbed by her taste for Planter's Punch at breakfast time, but they remained friends. He said of tallulah Bankhead, "She's the only woman I ever knew who could carry on a conversation, listen to the radio, read a book, and do her hair at the same time." Her famous lines were legion. "If a man answers, don't hang up," she'd say breathily. "It's me." Telling Norman Mailer how to spell. Feuding with Bette Davis and selected celebrities. It said she once ruined a Broadway opening night by sitting in the front row smoking a cigar. In England in the 20s, she was a fabulous success, smoking cigarettes, wearing tight, short skirts. On a return tour there, she said grandly that she was so grateful to England, scene of her greatest triumphs. But she said most of them are married now. Everyone was always trying to change her. Ethel Barrymore told her nearly 40 years ago that a name like tallulah would never make it on marquees. Her grandmother and her aunt tried to cure her of the chronic laryngitis that gave her that lioness's voice. One writer said that most people feel guilty about their sins, but that tallulah Bankhead was self-conscious about her virtues. So it was she could go on the wagon, depriving herself of her beloved booze for months during the 1952 presidential campaign in the belief that it would really somehow help Adlai Stevenson to win. Her monkey darling could chew up $800 of furniture at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston, her lion club become partial to the thighs of reporters. She said she could stand anything if it were not dull. And whether it was a New York Giants baseball game or a lavish party, if she was there, no chance of its being dull. 15 years ago, at 50, when she was a hugely successful star, still described as an extraordinarily beautiful woman, someone wrote of her, "Beneath the bravado and the violence, her lusty conversations and her excesses, there is the real tallulah, a soft and tremulous woman beset by moods of loneliness and emotional hunger." She was Sadie Thompson in Rain, Iris March in The Green Hat. She was Camille, the star of The Little Foxes, of Fallen Angels, Skin of Our Teeth, and Private Lives. The movies, Lifeboat, Tarnished Lady, My Sin, Faithless, and finally, Die, Die, My Darling.
NewsFront is brought to you through the facilities of the Eastern Educational Network.